I muse sometimes that Dostoevsky left the Russian army at 23 in order to pursue a literary career, and Rodion Raskolnikov is 23 in the dreadful summer when he gratuitously murders two women so as to aggrandize his Napoleonic vision of his self. There is a submerged affinity between Raskolnikov's refusal to swerve from his self-estimate and Dostoevsky's heroic quest to write eternal fictions, culminating in The Brothers Karamazov. Raskolnikov repents truly at last in the novel's unconvincing epilogue when he surrenders wholly to the Magdalene-like Sonya as the hope for his Lazarus ascension from death to salvation. But since Raskolnikov's tragic recalcitrance is inextricably bound up with Dostoevsky's heroic drive to compose great tragedy, the reader is unlikely to be persuaded by Raskolnikov's belated Christian humility. Dostoevsky is superb at beginnings, astonishing at middle developments, but oddly weak at endings, since his apocalyptic temperament, one might think, would render him adept in last things. Readers who are open to the experiential darkness of crime and punishment may well ponder the split not only in Raskolnikov, but the implied fissure in Dostoevsky himself, and may conclude that a recalcitrance in the novelist, dramatic rather than moral religious, renders him reluctant utterly to transform Raskolnikov into a redeemed being. Happy endings are not consonant with works that feature the awesome nihilists Svidrigaïlov and Iago. When I think of Crime and Punishment, immediately Svidrigaïlov comes into my mind, and I shudder at his explanation as he pulls the trigger to commit suicide. Going to America. This is the post-nihilist, mere nihilist will not suffice, who tells Raskolnikov that eternity exists. It is like a filthy bathhouse in the Russian countryside, crawling with spiders. Poor Raskolnikov, confronted with the real thing in Svidrigaïlov, the way down and out incarnate, can be forgiven when he yearns for a vision more comforting, whether he believes in it or not. There seems to me a real affinity between Raskolnikov and the murderer Macbeth, as there is between Svidrigaïlov and the Edmund of King Lear, another cold sensualist. Himself born in 1821, Dostoevsky more overtly associates the disturbing Svidrigaïlov with Lord Byron, made immensely popular in Russia by the national poet Pushkin, who also preceded Dostoevsky and Turgenev in their Shakespearean sympathies. Svidrigaïlov's criminal lusts, particularly excited by little girls, are a degradation of Edmund's and Byron's proclivities. But Raskolnikov, who is alarming enough, is several verges away from becoming a Svidrigaïlov, just as the murderous yet still sympathetic Macbeth is also a hero-villain rather than a peer of Iago and Edmund. Dostoevsky emulates Shakespeare by identifying the reader's imagination with Raskolnikov, even as Macbeth usurps our imaginations. Porfiry, the police inspector who brilliantly tortures Raskolnikov with uncertainty, presents himself as a Christian, but clearly causes distaste in Dostoevsky, who regards Raskolnikov's nemesis as a Western-influenced mechanist, a manipulator of Raskolnikov's already tormented psychology. Sonya is as spiritually beyond the reader in the transcendental dimension as uncanny Svidrigaïlov exceeds us in the demonic mode. We have no place to go but Raskolnikov's consciousness, just as we have to journey with Macbeth into his heart of darkness. We might not murder old women or a fatherly monarch, but since in part we are Raskolnikov and Macbeth, perhaps in certain circumstances we might. Like Shakespeare, Dostoevsky makes us complicit in his hero-villain's murders. Macbeth and Crime and Punishment both are authentically frightening tragedies that do not purge us of pity, let alone of fear. Reversing Aristotle's socio-medical idea of catharsis, in which tragedy frees us of emotions not conducive to the public good, both Shakespeare and Dostoevsky have darker designs upon us. It is this sharing in Macbeth's terrible sublimity that allows Crime and Punishment to transcend, depressing us, as we are led through a bad Petersburg summer in which a nightmare phantasmagoria becomes reality. Every wall we look at seems a hideous yellow, and the horror of a modern metropolis is portrayed with an intensity that rivals Baudelaire, or Dickens in his least affable moments. We begin to feel that in Raskolnikov's Petersburg, as in Macbeth's bewitched Scotland, we too might commit murders. The question of how to read Crime and Punishment rapidly becomes, what causes Raskolnikov to become a murderer? He is replete with good qualities, his impulses are essentially decent, indeed humane. I marvel at the eminent modern Italian novelist Alberto Moravia, who found Raskolnikov a forerunner of Stalinist commissars, who were better known for oppressing others than for tormenting themselves. Raskolnikov, like his demonic parody Svidrigaïlov, is a self-punisher whose masochism is absolutely incompatible with his professed desire to be a Napoleon. In one sense, Raskolnikov kills in order to discover whether he is a potential Napoleon, though he has every reason to believe that he is anything but that. Perhaps deeper is Raskolnikov's fierce guilt, which precedes his crimes. Whether he is a coarser version of Sonya's will to suffer, I rather doubt. Nor is he a passive double of Svidrigaïlov, all of whose malevolent sadism is a mask for going to America or suicide. It seems impossible to detach Raskolnikov from Dostoevsky, who at 28 endured 8 months in solitary confinement for being part of a radical group. Under sentence of death, he and his companions stood before a firing squad, and only then were reprieved. 4 years of hard labor in Siberia followed, during which Dostoevsky became a thorough reactionary, a monarchist, and a devout follower of the Russian Orthodox Church. Raskolnikov goes to Siberia for 7 years, a light sentence for a double murder, but he has confessed his crimes, and the court has found him to have been at least in part insane, particularly when he killed. I don't see how an open, common reader could ascribe, with any certainty, any motive to Raskolnikov's transgressions in any ordinary meaning of motive. Malignancy, deep-rooted in Svidrigaïlov, as in Iago and Edmund, has little place in the psyches of Raskolnikov and Macbeth, which makes their descents even more terrifying. Nor does one progress by looking for original sin in Raskolnikov and Macbeth. Both men suffer from powerfully proleptic or prophetic imaginations. Once either perceives a potential action to advance the self, he leaps the gap and experiences the crime as having been done, with all the attendant guilt. With so potent an imagination and so guilty a consciousness, the actual murder is only a copy or a repetition, a self-wounding that lacerates reality, yet just to complete what, in a way, has already been done. Absorbing as Crime and Punishment is, it cannot be absolved of tendentiousness, which is Dostoevsky's invariable flaw. He is a partisan whose fierce perspective is always explicit in what he writes. His design upon us is to raise us, like Lazarus, from our own nihilism or skepticism, and then convert us to orthodoxy. Writers as eminent as Chekhov and Nabokov have been unable to abide him. To them he was scarcely an artist, but a shrill would-be prophet. I myself, with each rereading, find Crime and Punishment an ordeal, dreadfully powerful but somewhat pernicious, almost as though it were a Macbeth composed by Macbeth himself. Raskolnikov hurts us because we cannot cut loose from him. Sonya seems to me quite unendurable, but even Dostoevsky did not have the power to create a sane saint. I wince before her. Yet it is extraordinary that Dostoevsky could give us two supporting characters as vivid as Porfiry, the police inspector, who is Raskolnikov's mighty opposite, and the amazingly plausible Svidrigaïlov, whose fascination is endless. Porfiry, an accomplished investigator, is a kind of pragmatist and a utilitarian, believing in the greatest good for the greatest number through the exercise of reason. Any reader, I assume, myself included, would rather dine with Porfiry than with the dangerous Svidrigaïlov. But I suspect Dostoevsky would have preferred Svidrigaïlov. Quite openly, Porfiry compares himself to a candle and Raskolnikov to a circling butterfly, in a wonderfully composed waiting game. "What if I run away?" asked Raskolnikov with a strange smile. "You won't run away. A peasant would run away, or a modern dissenter, the lackey of another's ideas, because you need only show him the end of your finger, and like Mr. Midshipman Easy, he will believe anything you like for the rest of his life. But you, after all, no longer believe even your own theory. Why should you run away? What would you do in hiding? The fugitive's life is hard and hateful, and your first need is for a definite position and existence and a suitable atmosphere. And what sort of atmosphere would you have? If you run away, you would come back of yourself. You can't get on without us." Translated by Jesse Colson. This is a deservedly classic moment in the history of detective novels. What could be finer than Porfiry's "You can't get on without us"? Candle speaking to butterfly. One feels in this instance that even the superb Chekhov was wrong, underestimating Dostoevsky as hazardous, even if you don't esteem him. More hazardous, and yet more memorable, is Svidrigaïlov, the authentic nihilist, and the end of what might be called the Shakespearean road in Dostoevsky, if one adds Stavrogin in The Devils. So strong and strange a character is Svidrigaïlov that I almost have to retract my assertion as to Dostoevsky's tendentiousness. Raskolnikov has confronted Svidrigaïlov, who has been pursuing Dunya Raskolnikov, the protagonist's sister. This is Svidrigaïlov on the woman who will reject him then and always. In spite of Evdokia Romanovna's real aversion for me and my persistently gloomy and forbidding aspect, she grew sorry for me at last, sorry for a lost soul. And when a girl's heart begins to feel pity for a man, then, of course, she is in the greatest danger. She begins to want to save him and make him see reason and raise him up and put before him nobler aims and awaken him to a new life and new activities. Well, everybody knows what can be dreamt of in such circumstances. I realized at once that the bird had flown into the net of its own accord, and I began to make preparations in my turn. "You seem to be frowning, Rodion Romanovich." "There is no need. The affair, as you know, came to nothing." "Devil take it. What a lot of wine I'm drinking." "You know, from the very beginning I always thought it was a pity that your sister had not chanced to be born in the second or third century of our era, as the daughter of a ruling prince somewhere, or some governor or proconsul in Asia Minor. She would doubtless have been one of those who suffered martyrdom, and she would, of course, have smiled when they burnt her breast with red-hot pincers. she would have deliberately brought it on herself. And in the 4th or 5th century, she would have gone into the Egyptian desert and lived for 30 years on roots, ecstasies, and visions. She is the kind of person who hungers and thirsts to be tortured for somebody, and if she does not achieve her martyrdom, she is quite capable of jumping out of a window. It is after Avdotya Romanovna's Dunya Raskolnikov failure to kill Svidrigaïlov, something he desires rather more desperately even than he does her, that Svidrigaïlov goes to America, shoots himself. Svidrigaïlov's freedom, like Stavrogin's in The Devils, is absolute, and also is absolutely terrifying. Raskolnikov never repents, though in the epilogue he breaks down and yields to Sonya's saintliness. But it is Svidrigaïlov, not Raskolnikov, who runs away from Dostoevsky's ferocious ideology, and indeed runs out of the book. A reader may well want to murmur to herself, Svidrigaïlov lives, though we probably won't scrawl that on subway walls. Henry James, The Portrait of a Lady. The Portrait of a Lady, my favourite among all of Henry James's novels, originally appeared in 1880-81. James revised extensively, more than a quarter century later, in 1908, for the definitive New York edition of The Novels and Tales of Henry James. 37, when he first sketched his portrait of Isabel Archer, James was 65 when he revised it. There are almost 2 Isabel Archers, so that the reader is well advised to choose a reprint carefully, the later version being preferable. No novelist, not even Cervantes or Austen or Proust, had James's vast consciousness. One would have to go back to Shakespeare to find, as Emily Dickinson phrased it, a larger demonstration that the brain is wider than the sky. Isabel Archer, always a heroine of consciousness, manifests a palpably expanded consciousness in the revision of 1908. Why read The Portrait of a Lady? We ought to read for many purposes and to gain copious benefits, but the cultivation of an individual consciousness is certainly a prime purpose and a major benefit of deep reading. Zest and insight. These are the attributes of the solitary reader's consciousness that are most enhanced by reading. Social information, whether past or contemporary, seems to me a peripheral gain of reading, and political awareness an even more tenuous dividend. As James revises The Portrait of a Lady, his near identity with Isabel Archer is augmented. Since Isabel is James's most Shakespearean character, her identity is placed in the reader's perspectives upon her. We are more guided by James in the revised version, so that it could be argued that Isabel was a richer, more enigmatic personality in 1881 than in 1908. Put another way, the most masterful of all American novelists seems to trust his readers less, and himself more, as his own perspectives upon Isabel changed. Isabel, in 1881, is a victim of her drive for autonomy. By 1908, James converts her partial loss of autonomy, caused by her errors of judgment, into a gain in her consciousness. She sees much more at the apparent cost of much of her freedom. To adopt one of our current modes, a feminist reader might be happier with the Isabel of 1881 than with the more Jamesian figure of 1908, whose prime concern is to stand beyond being deceived. Isabel's earlier attempt at self-reliance, brave but mistaken, is replaced by an emphasis upon the self's superior optics. Self-reliance is Ralph Waldo Emerson's prime doctrine, and Isabel Archer is one of Emerson's children, as James, on some interior level, must have been aware. Since Henry James Sr. never achieved independence from Emerson, his son's comments upon the Sage of Concord require wary reading. It is hardly too much or too little to say of Emerson's writings in general that they were not composed at all. But no one has had so steady and constant, and above all so natural a vision of what we require, and what we are capable of in the way of aspiration and independence. The rarity of Emerson's genius, which has made him so, for the attentive peoples, the first and the one really rare American spirit in letters. The first remark is absurdly condescending. Read Emerson's essay, Experience, and you may not agree with Henry James. But the second excerpt is pure Isabel Archer. That is precisely her vision. Whether James really meant the third extract, I rather doubt. He preferred Hawthorne, Emerson's uneasy walking companion. The passionate Hester Prynne in Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter seems to me even more an Emersonian heroine than does Isabel Archer, who flees passion, as did Henry James. Emerson was in love with both his wives, Ellen and Lydian, perhaps more passionately with Ellen, who died so young. James, not Emerson, is responsible for Isabel's repression of her sexual nature. Never much of a novel reader, Emerson read The Scarlet Letter, but underesteemed it, and I doubt that he would have admired The Portrait of a Lady. Yet he would have recognized in the idealistic Isabel a true child, and would have deprecated the aestheticism that led her to choose for a husband the dreadful Gilbert Osmond, a parody both of Emerson and of Walter Pater, high priest of the aesthetic movement in England. Reading The Portrait of a Lady for the first time, you may find it useful to realize that Isabel Archer is always mediated for you by the narrator, Henry James, and by her admirers, Ralph Touchett, Lord Warburton, and Caspar Goodwood, unforgivably outrageous name. Of Isabel as a dramatic personality in the Shakespearean sense, James is able to give us very little. We take her on faith, because James's skill at studying her consciousness is so elaborate and artful, and because she has so strong an effect upon everyone else in the novel, male or female, with the ironic exception of her husband, the poseur Osmond. For Osmond, she ought to be only a portrait or a statue. Her largeness of soul offends his narrowness. The crucial enigma of the novel, as every reader recognizes, is why did she marry the tiresome Osmond? And even more, why does she return to him at the end? Why do so many readers, women as well as men, fall in love with Isabel Archer? If you are an intense enough reader when you are still very young, your first love is likelier to be fictive than actual. Isabel Archer, famously termed by Henry James the heiress of all the ages, attracts many among us because she is the archetype of all those young women, in fiction or in actuality, who are pragmatically doom-eager because they seek complete realization of their potential while maintaining an idealism that rejects selfishness. George Eliot's Dorothea Brooke in Middlemarch aspires bravely, but her transcendental yearnings do not have the element added by Isabel Archer's Emersonianism, which is to drive for inward freedom almost at any cost. Since Isabel is Henry James's self-portrait as a lady, her consciousness has to be extraordinarily large, almost the rival of her creator's. This renders any reader's moral judgment of her character rather irrelevant. The novelist Graham Greene, a Jamesian disciple, insisted that James's moral passion in The Portrait of a Lady centers upon the idea of treachery, as exemplified by Madame Merle, who plots successfully to marry Isabel to Osmond so that he and Pansy, her daughter by Osmond, can enjoy Isabel's wealth. but Madame Merle, despite her deception, makes very little of a mark upon Isabel's capacious consciousness. Treachery obsessed Graham Greene far more than it did Henry James. Though The Portrait of a Lady is a kind of tragicomedy, few readers are going to be moved to laughter by the book. Despite the nasty vividness of Osmond and Madame Merle, and the different types splendidly exemplified by Isabel's admirers, Touchett, Warburton, Goodwood, James carefully sees to it that Isabel Archer is always at the center of our concern. It is indeed her portrait that matters. Everyone else exists only in relation to her. The figure of Isabel means too much to James, and to the sensitive reader, for any comic perspective upon her to be adequate. Nor is irony allowed to dominate James's account of her odyssey of consciousness, though her situation is almost absurdly ironic. She took Osmond in the delusion that she was choosing and granting freedom. He knew everything worth knowing, she had thought, and in turn he would wish her to know all that could be known of life. Her terrible error might almost seem to be a cruelty towards her on James's part, but he suffers with her and for her, and her mistake is absolutely central for the book. Error about life is necessary for life, Nietzsche remarked. Neither Henry James nor Isabel Archer is at all Nietzschean, but his adage illuminates Isabel's enormous blunder. What is it that has blinded Isabel? Or to ask that another way, why does James inflict such a catastrophe upon his own self-portrait as a woman? In James's revisions for the 1908 edition, Osmond is considerably darkened into authentic snobbishness, uselessness, and fakery, which makes Isabel's bad judgment all the more peculiar. James's first description of Gilbert Osmond is enough to warn the reader that Isabel's future husband is very bad news. He was a man of 40, with a high but well-shaped head, on which the hair, still dense but prematurely grizzled, had been cropped close. He had a fine, narrow, extremely modelled and composed face, of which the only fault was just this effect of its running a trifle too much to points, an appearance to which the shape of the beard contributed not little. This beard, cut in the manner of the portraits of the 16th century, and surmounted by a fair moustache, of which the ends had a romantic upward flourish, gave its wearer a foreign, traditionary look, and suggested that he was a gentleman who studied style. His conscious, curious eyes, however, eyes at once vague and penetrating, intelligent and hard, expressive of the observer as well as of the dreamer, would have assured you that he studied it only within well-chosen limits, and that in so far as he sought it, he found it. You would have been much at a loss to determine his original clime and country. He had none of the superficial signs that usually render the answer to this question an insipidly easy one. If he had English blood in his veins, it had probably received some French or Italian commixture, but he suggested, fine gold coin as he was, no stamp nor emblem of the common mintage that provides for general circulation. He was the elegant, complicated metal struck off for a special occasion. He had a light, lean, rather languid-looking figure, and was apparently neither tall nor short. He was dressed as a man who takes little other trouble about it than to have no vulgar things. Osmond, an American permanently settled in Italy, studied style, but only within well-chosen limits, and, in so far as he sought it, he found it. Wonderfully Jamesian, that tells the reader how narrow and dubious Osmond is. Contrast that to the novel's opening description of Isabel Archer. She had been looking all round her again, at the lawn, the great trees, the reedy, silvery Thames, the beautiful old house. And while engaged in this survey, she had made room in it for her companions. A comprehensiveness of observation easily conceivable on the part of a young woman who was evidently both intelligent and excited. She had seated herself and had put away the little dog. Her white hands in her lap were folded upon her black dress. Her head was erect, her eye lighted, her flexible figure turned itself easily this way and that, in sympathy with the alertness with which she evidently caught impressions. Her impressions were numerous, and they were all reflected in a clear, still smile. "I've never seen anything beautiful as this." Isabel studies not style, but people and places, and never within self-chosen limits. Intelligent and excited, knowingly beautiful, alert to her numerous impressions, amiably amused, it is no wonder that Ralph Touchett, Lord Warburton, and old Mr. Touchett have fallen in love with her at first sight, and that we will also, as we get to see her more clearly. The two initial descriptions in the 1908 edition are 170 pages apart, but the juxtaposition, though delayed, is direct and disconcerting. The sublime Isabel Archer, like the Shakespearean heroines Rosalind, Viola, Beatrice, Helena, and others, is compelled to marry down. But Ralph Touchett, Lord Warburton, and Caspar Goodwood are none of them potential disasters. Gilbert Osmond is a catastrophe. Each reader must judge for herself whether Henry James really makes Isabel's choice of Osmond persuasively inevitable. Much as I love James, Isabel, and the Portrait of a Lady, I have never been persuaded, and it seems to me the one flaw in an otherwise perfect novel. Isabel's blindness is necessary if the book is to work, but the more Jamesian Isabel of the 1908 revision simply seems too perceptive to be deceived by Osmond, particularly since James revises him into someone who quite definitely is not the heir of all the ages. James, subtlest of novelistic masters, excepting Proust, exerts all his art to make Isabel's misjudgment plausible. Osmond is, as he says, convention itself, whose theoretic function is to liberate us from chaos, but whose pragmatic effect is to stifle Isabel's possibilities. His daughter, Pansy, is for him primarily a work of art to be sold, preferably to a rich and noble husband. Osmond, a walking gold coin, sees in Isabel not only her fortune, bequeathed to her by her kinspeople, the Touchetts, but also material to work with, a portrait to be painted. But Isabel recognizes none of that until it is too late to save herself. Why? James gives us many hints, none definitive. There is Pansy, who awakens her maternal instincts. Her boy by Osmond dies at 6 months, and James intimates that the sexual relation between Osmond and Isabel dies soon after. And there is Isabel's growing obsession to choose a form of life. Ralph Touchett is her kinsman and is ill. Lord Warburton represents English aristocracy, which her Americanness shuns. Caspar Goodwood, her early Albany suitor, is too possessive and passionate, too much in love with her. Like Henry James, Isabel wants to be loved, but not to be the object of another's overwhelming sexual passion. James, in addition, ascribes Isabel's acceptance of Osmond, whose tastes are expensive, but whose income is slight, to the girl's, she is still very young, generous idealism, and to her guilt as to the Touchett inheritance. Is all this enough? I think not, as I've said already. But James is quite Shakespearean, and perhaps realistic in regard to the mysteries of marital choice. Shakespeare married Anne Hathaway, and then lived apart from her in London for 20 years, sending money to Stratford for her and the children, and going home as little as possible. James, homoerotic to the core, but not acting on it, expressed an extraordinary regard for the value and sanctity of heterosexual marriage, while dryly observing that he himself thought too little of life to venture upon the blessed state himself. I find more soluble, though still enigmatic, why Isabel returns to Rome and Osmond at the end of the story. Again, rejecting Goodwood, she nevertheless experiences and fears the force of his passion. He glared at her a moment through the dusk, and the next instant she felt his arms about her and his lips on her own lips. His kiss was like white lightning, a flash that spread and spread again and stayed. And it was extraordinary, as if, while she took it, she felt each thing in his hard manhood that had least pleased her, each aggressive fact of his face, his figure, his presence, justified of its intense identity and made one with this act of possession. So had she heard of those wrecked and underwater following a train of images before they sink. But when darkness returned, she was free. She is free to take a very straight path back to Rome and Osmond. That will keep her free of Goodwood, but life with Osmond can be at best only an armed truce. Is that to be the final fate of James's heiress of all the ages? James will not tell us, because his part in the story is over. He knows no more, and probably, at the close, Isabel does not know either. But what will become of her potential for greatness of spirit, for amplitude of consciousness, without which the book must sink? James has declined to give her alternatives to Osmond. Goodwood threatens her sense of autonomy, as somehow the wretched Osmond does not. But even in 1908, Isabel could have been her own alternative. Divorce and a financial settlement would free her from Osmond. Perhaps that yet may happen, but James gives us no clues towards this. Osmond, however mean-spirited, is not so formidable as Isabel. She goes back, I surmise, to work through the consequences of her idealistic blunder, and thus assert a continuity in her own consciousness. That is quite Jamesian, though readers are not wrong to protest against it. The Portrait of a Lady in its final form demands close and sympathetic reading. We may not be satisfied by Isabel's choice, but her story tells us again one motive for why we read: to know better the consciousness too valuable for us to ignore. Marcel Proust, In Search of Lost Time. How to read a novel now means to me how to read Proust, the final splendor of the classical novel. What shall we do when confronted by the absolute inventiveness of In Search of Lost Time? Proust's vast novel is narrated by the almost unnamed Marcel, a portrait of the novelist mostly as a young man, who gives us a labyrinthine recollection of French society from the closing decade of the 19th century down to 1922, the year of Proust's death. The novel's great themes, alphabetically listed, include aestheticism and beauty, brothels, the dead, who annex the living, dress, the Dreyfus Affair and its immersion in anti-Semitism, friendship, habits, inversion, homosexuality, both female and male, jealousy, above all. Literature itself and the gradual evolution of the narrator into a novelist, lying, memory as prevalent as sexual jealousy, sadomasochism, the sea, sleep, and time, about as omnipresent as jealousy and memory. In Search of Lost Time tells three love stories. Erotic might be a better word than love. Charles Swan, of Jewish origin but a leading socialite, becomes erotically obsessed with Odette de Crécy, whom he eventually marries after suffering all the torments of love and jealousy. Their daughter, Gilberte, is the narrator Marcel's first infatuation, before she marries his best friend, Saint-Loup, whose early passion was for the actress Rachel. Gilberte Swann is only a forerunner of the narrator's overwhelming love, Albertine Simonet, with whom Marcel has a long, complex affair terminated by her flight and subsequent death in a riding accident. Marvelous as are Proust's accounts of the jealous sufferings of Swann in regard to Odette and of Saint-Loup in relation to Rochelle, the apotheosis of what could be called the jealous sublime is achieved in Marcel's retrospective quest for the lost time of Albertine's lesbian betrayals of her possessive lover. One would have to turn to the Bible, Shakespeare, and Dante to find apt analogues for the narrator's zeal, intensity, and suffering as he searches for what Norman Mailer might call the time of Albertine's time. Shakespearean tragicomedy, as in Measure for Measure and Troilus and Cressida, comes closest to the superb irony and charmed rancidity of Marcel's grand quest. These days there are mutterings that the nameless narrator, twice rather teasingly referred to as Marcel in the 3,300 pages of the novel, is a Proustian evasion, since the narrator is heterosexual and Christian. The mutterings are obtuse. The gays and lesbians who abound throughout, like the Jews and Dreyfusards, gain in sympathy by the apparent disinterestedness of the narrator. Proust himself was, of course, homosexual, a Dreyfusard, and the son of a beloved Jewish mother. As a surrogate for the magnificent author, the narrator has the privilege of presenting the largest, most vital, and most varied constellation of characters to be encountered outside of Shakespeare. How to read a novel, and Proust in particular, is in the first place how to read and appreciate literary character. Alphabetically listed, the indispensable personalities in Proust are Albertine, Charlus, Françoise, Oriane de Guermantes, the narrator's mama, Odette, Saint-Loup, Swann, Madame Verdurin. Add a tenth in the narrator himself, and you have a roster more vivid, inward, and titanically comic than any other novel whatsoever affords us. Proust's cosmos is as ironic as Jane Austen's, yet the Proustian irony is less defensive and perhaps less an aid to invention. We can say that irony in Proust does not so much say one thing while meaning another, but rather makes intimations that are too large for any social context whatsoever. These intimations reach out to the corners of our consciousness and search for the principles of right action in us. It seems peculiar to call such irony mystical or quietistic, and yet it is the secular equivalent of a profound spirituality. One doesn't want to confuse Proust with Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, and yet Proustian memory finally seems a mode of right action that cures the narrator and the reader of what the ancient Hindu work warns against as dark inertia. We read novels, the greater ones, to treat ourselves for dark inertia, the sickness unto death. Our despair requires consolation and the medicine of a profound narration. Character in Proust's novel as in Shakespeare, does the healing work implicitly prescribed for it by a literary culture. It is a wretched social irony of our moment that a culture failed by all its conceptual modes, philosophy, politics, religion, psychoanalysis, science, is compelled to become literary rather in the mode of ancient Alexandria. Proust, like Shakespeare, a better physician than Freud, offers us his characters as humanely as Chaucer and Shakespeare presented theirs. All of Proust's characters are essentially comic geniuses. As such, they give us the option of believing that the truth is as funny as it is grim. Nietzsche, in one of his most Hamlet-like formulations, advised us that what we could find words for was something already dead in our hearts, so that there was always a kind of contempt in the act of speaking. Proust, unlike Shakespeare, is free of that contempt, and his grandest characters manifest his generosity. The deadness of our hearts, our selfish egoism, is an intense concern manifested more by sexual jealousy than by any other human affect, in Proust as in Shakespeare. I venture that novel reading now performs the labor of assuaging envy, of which a most virulent form is sexual jealousy. Since the two Western authors most supreme at dramatizing sexual jealousy are Shakespeare and Proust, the quest for how to read a novel can provisionally be reduced to how to read sexual jealousy. I sometimes feel that the best literary training my students at Yale and NYU can obtain is only an enhancement of their pragmatic training by sexual jealousy, the most aesthetic of all psychic maladies, as Iago knew. That must be why Proust compares the quests of his jealous lovers to the obsessions of the art historian, as when Swann reconstructs the details of Odette's sexual past with as much passion as the aesthete who ransacks the extant documents of 15th-century Florence in order to penetrate further into the soul of the Primavera, the fair Vanna, or the Venus of Botticelli. Presumably, art historians revel in this ransacking, whereas poor Swann gazes in impotent, blind, dizzy anguish over the bottomless abyss. Yet Swann provokes our comic pleasure by his sufferings, even as we wince. Reading about the fictive jealous agonies of others may not heal our parallel torments, and may never teach us a comic perspective applicable to ourselves, and yet the sympathetic pleasure aroused seems close to the center of aesthetic experience. In Proust, as in Shakespeare, the art itself is nature, an observation crucial to The Winter's Tale, which rivals Othello as Shakespeare's vision of sexual jealousy. Proust does not make us into Iago as we read, and yet we revel in his narrator's self-ruinings. For in Proust, every major character, but Marcel in particular, becomes his own Iago. Of all Shakespeare's villains, Iago is the most inventive at stimulating sexual jealousy in his prime victim, Othello. The genius of Iago is that of a great playwright who delights in tormenting and mutilating his characters. In Proust, many of the protagonists become instances of an Iago turned against himself. What gives more aesthetic pleasure than a pride of self-mutilating Iagos? My favorite passage in all of Proust comes after the narrator's beloved Albertine is dead, and results from his minute investigations into every detail of her lesbian passions. Albertine no longer existed, but to me she was the person who had concealed from me that she had assignations with women in Balbec, who imagined that she had succeeded in keeping me in ignorance of them. When we try to consider what will happen to us after our own death, is it not still our living self which we mistakenly project at that moment? And is it much more absurd, when all is said, to regret that a woman who no longer exists is unaware that we have learned what she was doing 6 years ago, than to desire that of ourselves, who will be dead, the public shall still speak with approval a century hence? If there is more real foundation in the latter than in the former case, the regrets of my retrospective jealousy proceeded none the less from the same optical error as in other men the desire for posthumous fame. And yet, if this impression of the solemn finality of my separation from Albertine had momentarily supplanted my idea of her misdeeds, it only succeeded in aggravating them by bestowing upon them an irremediable character. I saw myself astray in life, as on an endless beach where I was alone, and where, in whatever direction I might turn, I would never meet her. Translated by C. K. Scott Moncrief and Terence Kilmartin. How to read a novel might be epitomized as how to read this passage, which is Proust's search in miniature, and so is a model also of the traditional novel. Proust's vision of jealousy, quite Shakespearean, is that indeed it is in search of lost time and of lost space as well. Othello, Leontes, Swan, and Marcel all suffer the same optical error, the jealous resentment that there will never be enough time and enough space for themselves to enjoy Desdemona, Hermione, Odette, and Albertine. Such resentment is another mode of the ultimate outrage, the death of the lover rather than of the beloved. As a writer, Proust necessarily desires literary immortality, baldly reduced to public approval a century hence. Shakespeare's sonnets hover on the edge of associating sexual jealousy with the envy of rival poets. But only Proust genially ascribes both resentments to the wonderfully named optical error, doubtless one of those Nietzschean errors about life that are necessary for life. Reading Proust, we come to understand our own optical errors, the squalors of our own jealousies, yet also our motives for metaphor, for turning to read yet another novel. A grand comedian of the spirit, Proust now seems to have anticipated our burden of belatedness, of having arrived too late in the story, at the millennium. Proust defined friendship as being halfway between physical exhaustion and mental boredom, and said of love that it was a striking example of how little reality means to us. Whereas Nietzsche warned that lying was an exhaustion, Proust exalted the perfect lie as our opening upon newness. I referred earlier to the rapid diminishment of serious readers of the novel, and I realize, rereading Proust, that the flight from the novel is a rejection of wisdom literature. For where shall we still find wisdom? Proust's wisdom is not George Eliot's or Jane Austen's, and yet there seems to be a common sapience of the great novelists. Call it novelistic pragmatism, in which the only true differences are those that make a difference to the masters of prose fiction. Of death, Proust remarks that it cures us of the desire for immortality, which is an irony perhaps too savage for Eliot and Austen, but which legitimately extends their own battle against illusions. More profoundly, Proust finds innumerable ways of telling us that the self and society are irreconcilable, which does not mean that ourselves are mere delusions, whether of language or of social contexts. Our personality, as Proust says, is a composite army, which is a recognition implicit in George Eliot, and more emphasized by Proust, as befits his novel of novels, which touches true grandeur when it dares to name the lost Albertine as a mighty goddess of time. We can say that of Eliot's Dorothea Brooke in Middlemarch, or of Austen's Emma Woodhouse, but their creators could not. Proust teaches us both a retrospective divination by seeing his characters as divinities in time, and a retrospective jealousy, and hints that the two sensations are one. His heroes and heroines are like the gods in Homer, who also are consumed by sexual jealousy and strife. Despite Proust's healing power, I cannot read a novel in quite the way I did half a century ago, when I lost myself in what I read. I first fell in love, if I remember accurately, not with an actual girl, but with Marty South in Thomas Hardy's The Woodlanders, and I grieved dreadfully when she cut off her beautiful hair in order to sell it. Few other experiences quite touch the reality of falling in love with a heroine and with her book. One measures oncoming old age by its deepening of Proust, and its deepening by Proust. How to read a novel? Lovingly, if it shows itself capable of accommodating one's love, and jealously, because it can become the image of one's limitations in time and space, and yet can give the Proustian blessing of more life. Thomas Mann, The Magic Mountain. When I was a boy, first reading Fiercely some 60 years ago, Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain was widely received as a work of modern fiction almost comparable to Joyce's Ulysses and Proust's In Search of Lost Time. I have just reread The Magic Mountain, 1924, for the first time in 15 years, and am happy to discover again its undiminished pleasure and power. Anything but a period piece, it is as fresh and sharp a reading experience as ever it has been, though subtly altered by time. Mann has unfortunately been somewhat eclipsed during the last third of this century, being anything but a novelist of the counterculture. The Magic Mountain cannot be read sandwiched in between On the Road and some chunk of cyberpunk. It represents the high culture that is now in some jeopardy, since the book demands considerable education and reflection. Its protagonist, Hans Kastorp, a young German engineer, arrives to visit his cousin at a tuberculosis sanatorium in the Swiss Alps, intending only a brief visit. Kastorp, once he himself is diagnosed with the disease, stays 7 years on the Magic Mountain to be cured, and also to continue his Bildung, or cultural education and development. Mann initially describes Hans Kastorp as a perfectly ordinary young man, but this is an irony. Kastorp is no everyman, nor is he essentially a spiritual quester, at least to begin with, but he is hardly ordinary. Endlessly teachable, immensely susceptible to profound conversation and to study, Kastorp undergoes a remarkable advanced education on the Magic Mountain, primarily through speaking and listening to antithetical teachers. Settembrini, Italian liberal humanist and disciple of the poet and freethinker Carducci, who comes first and asserts his priority, and then, halfway through the novel, Naphta. Naphta is a radical reactionary, a Jewish Jesuit nihilist Marxist who opposes democracy, looks back to the medieval religious synthesis, and who laments the European falling away from faith. The debates between Settembrini, standing for the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and Naphta, apostle of the Counter-Reformation, are always merciless, reaching an early crux when Naphta cries out a prophecy of what was to triumph in Germany a decade after publication of The Magic Mountain. "No," Naphta continued, The mystery and precept of our age is not liberation and the development of the ego. What our age needs, what it demands, what it will create for itself, is terror. Translated by John E. Woods. Both NAFTA and Settembrini engage the reader's attention, but only Settembrini, despite Mann's endless ironies, causes us to grow fond of him. Irony is at once Mann's most formidable resource, and perhaps his ultimate weakness, as he knew. His protest in 1953 against his critics remains useful. I always feel a bit bored when critics assign my own work so definitely and completely to the realm of irony, and consider me an ironist through and through, without also taking